in your schedules. This is not our typical time to have oral argument. We're here for 19-3031, U.S. versus Dobie. Counsel, are you ready?
Judge Hartz, and may it please the court, my name is Dan Hansmeyer. I'm an attorney with the Federal Public Defender for the District of Kansas, and I am here on behalf of Mr. Dobie. Where to begin? So we're here on an issue involving pretrial conditions of release. I think there are two things to talk about, two different statutes within the Bail Reform Act, Section 3142C3 and Section 3145A. If I could, I just want to begin with 3142C3 because I think this is the easiest way to resolve this case. So that provision essentially gives a judicial officer the authority to amend conditions of supervised release at any time. That's the quote. So when you look at the facts of this case, we filed a motion to amend citing that provision, among other things. And so for whatever reason, we challenged three conditions. The magistrate judge actually struck one, but then the other two made their way to the district court. So the magistrate didn't consider the other two. So I think there's the initial question is why, and I'm not sure, but I think because of the language in 3142C3, the easiest thing to do in this case is to remand to the magistrate and essentially order the magistrate to consider our motion in the first instance. The government doesn't really give any pushback to that in its supplemental brief. In its initial brief, it talks about how 3142C3 uses the phrase additional or different, and essentially I think what the government is saying, therefore you can't remove a condition. But I think practically speaking, that doesn't make any sense as a textual matter, particularly the word different. I think it's difficult to comprehend what different could mean in front of the word additional, if not to that in a way that would include removing a condition. And I think, so one example is, say, a defendant is detained and the court imposes a curfew condition, and then later on down the road, everybody agrees that there is no need for it. As I read the government's position, the magistrate could not get rid of the curfew position, and that just seems wrong, and certainly not what Congress would have intended, especially when you look at the Bail Reform Act as a whole, and the whole purpose of setting conditions of release. The conditions have to be the least restrictive. So if we're going to honor that portion of the statute, it would make sense that if, you know, a condition becomes more restrictive, it must be removed.
Well, the district court, it's my recollection, did push back on that and did say that that language did not contemplate on its face. It spoke to what a magistrate judge could do. It didn't speak to what, if it wanted to do that, it didn't speak to any sort of procedure where you would file a motion to have the magistrate judge do anything.
I'm not sure I understand. I agree.
Well, let me rephrase. The language says a judicial officer may at any time amend the order. It doesn't say so fine. The judicial officer is empowered to do that. It doesn't say the judicial officer has to do it. It could do it sua sponte. It doesn't say it sets up no mechanism for you to file a motion to get relief. Does it? It doesn't say anything about you activating this by doing anything, and it doesn't say what that thing would be that would activate it.
I mean, I guess technically not. It doesn't use the word motion.
Technically it doesn't, and that's right. What the district court said. So what's your case that says that, in fact, this works for you, that you can activate it by taking some action, like filing a motion?
Right. Well, I don't think there is that has ever arisen, that issue. I don't. But I mean, I do know as a practical matter, If you read the cases, that there are motions to modify that the magistrate considers under 3142. I mean, in this case, the magistrate struck one of the conditions from the motion to modify. So I think, practically speaking, if the statute authorizes a magistrate to do something, we think that that means the parties can move the magistrate to do that. We think it goes both ways. The government could ask for a modification. We could ask for a modification, and probation does as well. That happened in this case. So, I mean, I understand the point that the statute doesn't say expressly you can file a motion, but I think in practice that's certainly a plausible thing. And
I'm not saying it's not plausible. All I'm saying is the district court took a position to suggest that this provision speaks to the court. Mm-hmm. And all I'm saying is I think that's equally plausible. Mm-hmm. And so if you're asking us to choose your view of plausibility over the district court's view, give me something.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Well,
I understand.
A second issue with that, though. Maybe you touched on it and I missed it, but it says the judicial officer. It doesn't say a.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems to be directed at the judicial officer who initially set conditions. Is that correct?
Yes. No, I agree with that. And that's, I guess my position is the magistrate judge who set the conditions should have ruled on the entirety of the motion. That's our sort of...
Wait.
So in this case, we filed a motion to modify to strike three conditions. The magistrate judge actually granted that motion in part and struck one condition. And then the other two conditions, for whatever reason, went to the district court. And all I'm saying is that the easiest way to get rid of this appeal is to send this case back for the magistrate judge, not the district court, for the magistrate judge to rule on the other two conditions as well.
Okay, then I misunderstood. I thought you were appealing the district court's denial. You're appealing action by the magistrate judge as well?
Well, no, because the
So how do we get to that? Mm-hmm. So the issue before us, I thought, was can we review the district court? Well,
mm-hmm.
Did the district court err by denying relief?
Correct.
And the district court is not covered by 3142.
Correct.
C3. So what's your argument that the district court erred in denying relief?
So if this court does not want to send it to the magistrate judge and we're focusing on the district court and whether the district court erred.
When you say that if this court doesn't want to, I thought you just acknowledged that that's not before us.
Well, no, I think so.
How is the magistrate judge's decision before us? I thought the decision before us is the district court's opinion, but I may be
missing something. So in the district court, we invoked two statutes, 3142 C3 and 3145A.
Okay.
I think
you agree that the judicial officer in 3142 C3 is the magistrate judge.
And that's why you would send it back to the magistrate judge. Because we invoked that provision. The magistrate should have done it in the first instance and didn't do it. So under 3142 C3, the easy thing to do is say, magistrate, deal with this in the first instance, and then you don't even have to get to the 3145 issue. But we can move on to the 3145.
Well, how did it get to the district court judge?
I honestly don't know.
Somebody filed it there, I assume.
Well, we filed the motion, but to the extent that it went to the magistrate as opposed to the district court, I don't know. But it didn't. I mean, initially, the magistrate struck one of the conditions.
So your relief is, despite the district court having ruled, we just bypass the district court, send it back to the magistrate.
I think when the district court, in this instance, rules by refusing to rule, that makes sense, yes.
So you didn't seek review by the district court, is what you're saying?
We did, to the extent that we just filed a motion to modify. That's all we did. We filed a motion to modify the pretrial conditions.
With what?
With the court in the case. As far as I know, you can't file something with the magistrate or the district court. You just file it in the case through PACER. I don't know how you get it to the magistrate opposed to the district court.
I actually assumed that was an appeal, essentially, because the gist of your motion was that the magistrate judge had violated constitutional rights.
Well, the motion as a whole actually reads as if it could have been addressed to the magistrate judge as well. I mean, that doesn't ever say district court. We talk about that in our initial memorandum brief. I mean, there's a point at which it's clearly directed to the magistrate judge, to be honest with you.
Well, what?
May I ask to recall? So there were a sequence of two documents, though, right? And initially you sought relief from the magistrate judge. Magistrate judge struck one condition. Then you file another document, or
no.
There was only one document?
There was only one.
Okay, so you file one document. The magistrate judge acts on that one condition, mm-hmm. leaving the two there at some level of pendency, and then the district court acted.
Yes.
Was there any subsequent action by you to seek relief as it relates to the two conditions?
The magistrate just ruled on it. We didn't file a...
Denied the other two conditions.
It's basically... The district court said our motion was untimely. That's how it denied it.
I understand that, and I'm just trying to remember procedurally. I guess the sequencing that I want to confirm or deny is this. You file this one document challenging three conditions. Magistrate judge grants you relief as to the one condition. Without doing any other act by you, the district court makes a decision as it relates to to that document that has been filed, saying we won't address the merits, but we will deny it as untimely.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I'm running out of time. I do want to reserve some time for rebuttal. I really didn't get to 3145, but if I could just make one point on that and then reserve the remainder of time. And I think the one reason why we have to be right on 3145 is because if Rule 59's 14-day requirement applies in this context, Section 3145A is entirely meaningless. There's no reason it even exists.
Well,
because what Rule 59 says is a motion, you know, a party may file objections within 14 days. If that's the rule, that procedure exists. If you strike 3145 from the books, the procedure would be the same.
No. 3145, if someone's held in another district, say they're indicted in Colorado,
okay,
and arrested in Arizona.
Okay.
A magistrate judge in Arizona sets bail.
Okay.
This enables you to go to the court which has original jurisdiction over the offense.
Correct.
And get a new ruling.
I completely agree with that.
So that's something that's not covered in the other section, is it?
Well, if the government says that any bail order is a Rule 59A order, and if that's true...
No, that's only when you're being reviewed by the district court that conferred authority on the magistrate judge. So in the case I talked about, the magistrate judge in Arizona did not get its authority from the district court in Colorado. It got it from the district court in Arizona.
Well, actually, it gets its authority from 636A.
Whichever. I mean, we won't debate that. But it did not. It certainly didn't get its authority from the district court having the original jurisdiction over the case. What we're talking about is when a district court reviews a decision by a magistrate judge under that district court, not a magistrate judge from another district.
I mean, I don't really follow any of that. This court's decision in Cisneros was that fact pattern, and that case aligns with our position. There is no 14-day requirement there. There shouldn't be one here.
That was before the rule also.
It did precede Rule 59. That's correct. But
I don't think the rule would apply anyway in that circumstance when the magistrate judge is from a different district.
I think the point that what I understood Judge Hartz to
say
is that he was explaining why you had initially said 3145A would not have any vitality if we were to apply Rule 59 to it. And what Judge Hartz's hypothetical suggests is, yes, it would, because there are circumstances in which you would have a magistrate ruling who was not under the district court judge who would be situated to amend the order.
That's what I meant to say.
But I don't see where the rules talk about a magistrate under the district court. I don't get that anywhere, to be honest with you.
So you're saying it could be that, but it could be the other situation too.
I mean, my basic point, if I could finish this, I'm running out of time, is that if Rule 59 applies to any order, including a bail order, that means that you have 14 days to object to it, period. And if that's true, there's no point in 3145 at all. And in your situation, Judge Hartz, I don't think that means, even if the magistrate is in one district and the other, I think Rule 59 applies across the board. No, you have 14 days.
Read 59A to start. A district judge may refer to a magistrate judge for determination any matter. That sets the stage. It's cases where the district court refers a matter, maybe by a general rule or maybe by specific designation, but there's no way the district judge in Colorado referred the matter to the magistrate judge in Arizona. There's no way. So in that circumstance, I don't think 59A would apply.
I can't imagine Congress had it. I mean, there's We're just no way 59A Congress...
Is 59A is not a congressional act.
I mean, it's just implausible that Congress drafted Section 3145 just to govern that small subset. That's completely implausible, especially when Section 3145 has been around since 1984. It's part of the Bail Reform Act. It was meant to give district courts authority over cases. I'm way over time, so I will thank you.
Mr. Brandt?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, James Brown for the United States. Your Honors, I'm not quite sure where to start after that last discussion.
Can we start here? That a defendant goes in to the detention hearing, receives some conditions. Over the course of the pretrial release, things change after 14 days. Is that just locked away, can't be challenged anymore?
Well, that can
be challenged. Other than the court on its own motion?
It can be challenged in two ways. The first way, the court mentioned conditions changed. That can be challenged under Section 3142F, which explicitly allows for...
You hit the mic, I'm sorry. 31 what?
3142F, which allows for reopening the detention hearing if the conditions have changed.
Can you read me the language you're relying on? If you have it in front of you?
Yes. USC 3142F says, the hearing may be reopened before or after determination by the judicial officer at any time before trial if the judicial officer finds that information exists that was not known to the movement at the time of the hearing and it has a material bearing on the issue, whether there are conditions of release that will reasonably assure the appearance of such persons required and the safety of any other person and the community.
And that's a limited realm of activity. In other words, why would it would seem to me that if you had a defendant who at the time knew of the condition's impact, but thought that it would work. It turns out it doesn't work. That's not necessarily information that he didn't have at the time, and I would bet you that the government lawyer sitting at the table would make that argument. And so this principle would not avail that person. So I don't see how that option works. You said you had two. Give me your other one.
The other option would be 18 USC 3142C3 that Your Honor talked about earlier with my colleague. In 3142C3, it states that the judicial officer may at any time amend the order to impose additional or different conditions of release. Now, where this statute most often takes place is, say, if the probation office says this condition isn't working, we need a new condition because the defendant is not complying, a probation officer will sometimes send the magistrate a request that the conditions be modified, and the court can modify the conditions under that section. My colleague pointed out that section naturally allows a defendant to file a motion, and the court pointed out, Judge Holmes pointed out, that in the district court's order, the district court stated that just states when the judge may consider it, not when the defendant files it. That rule is silent on if a defendant can file a motion, but it's often the case, as my colleague pointed out, that attorneys file motions to take advantage of something or to request relief. And if the defendant filed a motion in that case, there's nothing that prevents him from doing that. The court may or may not amend the conditions. So that's another avenue that...
Does the court at least have to consider it?
Well, the statute doesn't say that the court has to consider the merits of defendant's claim. It looks like from the statute, and I'm referring to 3142C3, that the court has discretion to even consider the motion in the first instance, because it says may or may not. The court, it doesn't set a mandate to consider the merits of any motion filed. The court can just say, I exercise my discretion not to review it based upon what I already know or based on the contents of the motion.
Could you tell us what happened procedurally here? This is something I'm not familiar with, where a motion is filed, the magistrate rules on it in part, then without any other document being filed, the district judge rules on it in part?
That's not quite our understanding, and I think maybe the court's order, document 38, page 1, clears it up. What happened is we filed an indictment charging defendant with failure to register, and then we included... Court says for persons charged under the Adam Walsh Act that mandates pretrial release conditions be imposed. And there were two hearings here. The magistrate imposed conditions on July 3rd. Defendant did not object. And then over 4 months later, in November 7, 2018, the defendant filed his motion before the district court. So 4 months after...
Well, he said he just filed it without saying who it was directed to, whether it was the magistrate judge or the district court.
Well,
did it say any language saying specifically seeking relief from the district court as opposed to the magistrate judge?
The district court apparently took it upon, I'm just inferring from the record, but given the presumptions of regularity, it appears from the record, and I don't have it in front of me, that it was filed in the district court. I don't have the motion, unfortunately. The district court apparently thought it was filed before the district court and then took up the motion. And I think my colleague admits...
But I thought it was based on that document that the magistrate judge changed one of the conditions of relief.
There may have been two hearings before the magistrate. There may have been two hearings before the magistrate, and it could have been at the second hearing the magistrate changed one of the conditions of release, of supervised release, and the defendant filed his motion in front of the district court 4 months later, contesting the constitutionality of conditions imposed.
Well, what defense counsel indicated is that the change by the magistrate judge was in response to this order, I'm sorry, to this motion that was filed and taken up by the district court. This is, I did not understand this. Before.
Well, I'm going off what the defendant said in his brief, and I think what the defendant said is that they filed their motion under 3145A2. That would be a motion before the district court, an appeal of a magistrate's decision. So I'm assuming, based upon what is stated in the briefs, that they filed that under the statute, they said 3145A2, and that's a motion before the district court. So the district court took up a motion that was filed in front of the district court.
They filed it under, they also claimed to file it under C3. And their premise, right, and their premise would have been that could have been directed at the magistrate judge. In fact, that would have been the judge to act on.
If they had, I'm not sure of the first part of the court's question that they also claimed they filed it under C3. That could be. That's not what I recall from the briefing, and I'm not contesting the court's recollection on that point. That's just not what I recall.
I think you're misremembering the briefing.
I apologize. I apologize if I'm misremembering the record. I definitely apologize. With that being said, we're up in front of the district court, and the district court considered a motion before it that the defendant says was filed under 3145A2. Now, it might be that it was also filed in front of the magistrate judge, and the magistrate judge just didn't take it up. I'm not sure from the record, but there's no record of the magistrate judge, I don't think, taking it up or not taking it up.
Is it a clerk of court issue? The motion comes in and the clerk puts it on somebody's calendar?
You know, that could be, and I don't think this record speaks to that. And it could be, but usually if these... I mean, that very well could be.
The magistrate's on vacation, say.
I suppose I can hypothecate a situation where a clerk in the clerk's office sees this motion and puts it up in front of the district court, and where it should go to the magistrate court. But here we have the defendant stating in his briefing that it was filed under 3145A2 and should have been filed under 3142C3.
Well, the district court has power to hear it too, right? Or are you on the A and the D thing?
Yes. District court has power to hear that.
Under what?
The district court has power to entertain that motion.
The C3 motion?
Yes. Yes, the district court has the discretion to entertain that or not.
I thought
under 3145A2, the district court does.
Yes. Yeah.
Under C3, no.
Okay.
Thanks for correcting me,
okay.
Your Honor.
And if you look at this motion that we're talking about that the district court denied, it sure looks like an appeal from the magistrate judge, because it's saying the conditions of release imposed by the magistrate judge are unconstitutional. Isn't that the gist of that motion?
That's the gist of the motion, yes. And the court said, the district court said, I'm just going to refuse to exercise my discretion to adjudicate the merits of the motion, and dismissed it on that basis. Because it decided not to exercise its discretion to do it because there were no changed circumstances.
Didn't exercise its discretion under the rule to consider an untimely motion? Didn't it say it's untimely, but as the commentary to the rule says, I still have discretion to consider an untimely motion, and then said it won't exercise that discretion? Or am I misunderstanding what the district court said?
Your Honor's understanding is correct. That's exactly what the district court said.
That's the first time today I've gotten.
Is 3142F talking about revocations? We're going to make a change on whether or not the person is detained as opposed to modification of conditions.
I think that the fairest reading is that they go together, because it says the hearing may be reopened at any time, if information not known to the movement before has a material bearing on the issue of whether there are conditions of release, so it does go to conditions of release, that will reasonably ensure the appearance of such persons required and the safety of any other person in the community. Obviously, if they're not conditions, I didn't mean to interrupt.
That sounds like, well, I'm the one interrupting, so I apologize, but that sounds to me like the government says, oh my gosh, we were kind to this fella, and what's he doing? He's on the computer again. Your Honor, we need to have another hearing on terms of release, and this time we're going to say detention, as opposed to modifying a single term or adding a term.
Well, the hypothetical the court gives there is that is the defendant's on the computer in violation of his conditions. You know, that arose after the conditions were imposed, and that was not a circumstance known to the movement before. So it doesn't seem like that would really be the section that would apply, because this applies if there is information exists that was not known to the movement at the time of the hearing, and that has material bearing. Mm-hmm. So we think in that circumstance, the proper avenue would be 3142C3, which of course states the judicial officer may at any time amend the order to impose additional or different conditions of release. So we think that's the proper avenue for the district court.
Wait, in what circumstance does F not apply? When it sounded like there was a change in conditions, or a change in
he Judge Phillips, I thought, gave me a hypothetical where, after the conditions were imposed, saying the defendant could not be on computer, we find out the defendant's on computer, and so that would not be a fact that was...
Sure, that's a fact that wasn't known at the outset, at the prior hearing.
Well, it's not new information.
Why is that not new information?
The court is... Let me look at that one more. I may be misspeaking here, and I apologize if I am. If the judicial officer finds that the information exists that was not known to the movement at the time of the hearing,
well, I guess that would apply then. So the court is absolutely correct. I apologize for misstating the law.
On this, and I don't want to spend too much time on it, but in your brief, supplemental brief, you make this waiver, plain error argument. Why is that valid? I mean, the fact of the matter is, in your response below, you didn't mention 59, and so the defendant didn't have any knowledge that 59 was even in play. Tell me why I'm wrong about that.
Well, you know, we're just going on the basis of how the plain error doctrine is often applied, where the defendant raises an issue for the first time on appeal.
If it could raise it before.
Well, if he didn't...
That's a condition. You don't have to raise something that you couldn't realize was at play.
Well, usually, what happened here is that, and our plain error argument goes to the 636A versus 636B and whether that controls whether Rule 59A applies.
That's and the implication of Rule 59A, its operation here, was never known or talked about until the district court issued its decision.
Right. And there,
once you say right, then
it seems to me you're done
there.
On that.
What the defendant is saying is because he didn't have an opportunity to object, then the plain error rule should not apply.
Right.
We understand that, and we understand the argument. Our counter argument to that would be that he has an option to file a motion to reconsider. That constitutes an opportunity to object. If the court doesn't want to go there and the court doesn't want to entertain the plain argument, we can certainly understand it based on the arguments that have been made. But we don't think it's completely out of line as long as the defendant had an opportunity to object through a motion to reconsider, which he does under Kansas local rules. He has 14 days to file that motion. So he had the order, he reviewed the order, and he could have said, wait a minute, this was never talked about, and then file a motion to address the issue. He didn't.
That's why we raised it. I think we have a circuit precedent saying there's no obligation to file a motion to reconsider.
Then if that is what the court wants to rely upon, we completely understand that. We're just raising issues.
I'm not faulting you, Mr. Brown.
I just
wanted to test it. That's all.
We're not trying to make frivolous arguments for the court.
I did not imply anything like that.
Appreciate that.
Any further questions?
No.
Nothing. Thank you.
Thank you.
The posture has changed circumstances. Like you don't want to. You have nothing more to say. You're not doing us a favor by talking. If you have something that you think needs to be said, I can give you a minute.
Well, I'll say, just to be crystal clear, the motion cites 3142C3. So I know the government seemed to imply that we didn't, but we did.
He agreed he could have been wrong on that.
So both statutory grounds were relied on below, and... Other than that, I'll just rest on the briefs. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Case is submitted. Counselor excused. Court will be in recess until 8:30 tomorrow morning.